And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Barry Wolverton to the program today. Barry enjoyed a good deal of success for his debut novel for younger readers, Neversink. Today we'll talk about the first book in his new series, Chronicles of the Black Tulip. Volume 1 is entitled The Vanishing Island, and it's published by Walden Pond Press. Barry, as the book opens, a Dutch sailor by the name of Jacob Banders is terrified. What has him spooked?
First of all, I'm really impressed that you pronounced that.
I looked it up.
in the Dutch way. Can't wait for an old coworker of mine, Brian Beenders, to read that, because the reason that name stuck in my head was his name was Beenders, and he did some genealogy research and discovered he was Dutch, and so we started around the office calling him Beenders and, you know, making fun of him like that. And then when I needed a Dutch name, I was like, Beenders. He's spooked because he thinks someone's following him.
On a ship at sea.
On a ship at sea. Yes, that should give you a clue that the person he suspects following him may have some extraordinary abilities.
For the main part of the book, I'm assuming this takes place in 1599 as well? Mm-hmm. Or
it does.
It seems when we get scared, oftentimes we'll go back to those fears of childhood. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that he has in his mind, is something his mother had told him about when he was a child.
The night demon, which is actually a real folkloric boogeyman from Dutch-Belgian region. This black-clad boogeyman with fangs and claws who hides under your bed or in your wardrobe. If you don't go to sleep at night, we'll come out and leave the mark on you.
And with all the kind of current controversy about the Dutch Santa's helper, St. Nicholas's helper, Black Pete, I'm not real fond of Dutch folklore anymore.
I know. Well, you know, a lot of European folklore would not really be up to date for today's times. Yeah, Black Pete. I even thought about using one called the Black Gang, which referred to a group of dwarves or elves, like, you know, live underground. And it seemed to go well with people who work in the hull of a ship. But, you know, then I was like, Black Gang will not sound good in a 21st century children's novel. But there's definitely some objectionable Dutch and European folklore in general out there. But there's also some fascinating stuff. Like, are you familiar with the Dutch legend of Starchy?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
No, Stiffy. I think his name is Stiffy. Yeah, the Dutch have a bit of folklore about the invention of clothing starch. I think that's fascinating. So what a great people, you know.
Probably not the most exciting people nowadays.
No, not exciting. But
very tall, so I guess you can relate to
them. Very tall and very starch collars.
When the book begins in earnest, we meet a young 12-year-old boy named Bryn Owen, and he's a wannabe sailor, and he lives in a town called Map. Why does he want to leave Map so badly?
Because Map is a coastal town. His father's a mapmaker. Bryn has been exposed to all these sailors who come through port day after day with these probably exaggerated tales of fame and fortune on the high seas. He's also watched his father make these maps of the ever-expanding world in this first great information age, and he's just convinced that a better life is out there for him.
And Map is in Cornwall. What would it be close to, like a contemporary city?
Exactly.
What would it be close to?
I can't remember which town I based it on. I just remember, looking at the Cornish Peninsula and sort of that tip that hangs off that just looked like...
Like Penzance down
there? Yeah, a little bit, I guess, northwest of Penzance, but yeah.
And, of course, Cornwall is like where the traditional pirate dialect comes from.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't want this book to be, you know, like Arg and sort of Pirates of the Caribbean sort of thing. I wanted it takes place a little bit, you know, before that Victorian seafaring stuff that more people read and they make TV shows and movies about. And I try not to have too much of that cliched pirate stuff in there. You know, Robert Louis Stevenson covered that ground, and it's been covered amply. So there are no peg leg pirates in my book or eye patches or anything like that.
But there are some references that let us know, like the country he lives in is called Britannia, not England at the time. Spain and Portugal are referred to as Iberia, and there are a few other kind of anachronisms split there. So we know it's not our history. You've created your own world here.
Exactly. It's an alternate history, not radically different. Some of my favorite books are The Wolves of Libby Chase that Joan Aiken wrote, which they take place in a sort of a barely fictionalized Britannia. James III is the king, you know, that sort of thing. And it's very recognizable, but at the same time, if you pay attention to the details, you know that you're in a fantasy. And that's kind of what I wanted, the verisimilitude of history, but not a complete world building of a high fantasy universe.
because you have an equivalent of the Dutch East India Company, mm-hmm. a great shipping and trading power from the Netherlands, and it has bicycle in its mm-hmm. title, and bicycles were still a couple hundred years away.
Exactly. I knew someone smart like you would notice that. Here was my rule. I discussed this with my editor. My rule on anachronisms was, if it's plausible that it could have been invented a couple hundred years earlier, that's okay. I mean, the bicycle is an incredibly simple technology. The wheel had been invented. Metal had, you know, had been invented. There's really no reason the bicycle couldn't have been around then. And in fact, I'm kind of surprised they haven't found a bicycle prototype in China somewhere that, you know, from 6,000 years ago. Now, I wouldn't have had, you know, lasers or something like that in the book, but I was okay with anachronisms like that if it was sort of plausible.
One accidental anachronism I found that I didn't even realize was one. I was just looking up what the definition of rapscallion was. I always knew kind of a ne'er-do-well or something mm-hmm. like that. But some of those older insults were very real, and they were fighting words, essentially, if you called one that. And I found out that rapscallion came from 1699.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'm going to refer to William Goldman, who wrote, I can't remember the name of it right now, but he wrote an interesting seafaring book, and he was complaining about people who nitpicked language anachronisms, because he was saying, look, just because it was finally encoded in a dictionary at this time, or that's the earliest usage that someone making a dictionary could find, that doesn't mean it wasn't in use before.
I was just so surprised myself that it's, because it sounds like such a great kind of like Middle English word.
It
almost
does. It sounds very old. And you probably noticed I also played a little bit. I did some research into Dutch slang in particular because, you know, the language is interesting to me. Like they call the doctor a quacksalver. You know, that's sort of specific to that region. Whereas, you know, like in the Old West here in America, they would have called him a sawbones or something like that. I was interested in sort of regional insults like that. And then things like I call the back of the ship the caboose, which is a Dutch word but wasn't used for ships. That was part of my alternate history, is like wanting to play a little bit with some of those terms.
Your guys could have been the first ones to employ the term.
Absolutely.
Now, as you mentioned, Bryn's father works for a map maker whose name is Rand McNally.
That's right.
Of course, that's another clue that we're not in our own history.
It's a clue for some people. There are a lot of people who think Rand McNally was a historical figure, including me when I began to research this. I was kind of excited about fictionalizing Rand McNally, and then I discovered, as you obviously know, that there was no Rand McNally. It was two different people, a Mr. Rand and a Mr. McNally, who had two different companies. I think it was Chicago where they originated, and they merged to form the map company that we know. And it also did not exist in the 16th century.
So at 1599, in your world, what's kind of like the known world? What is known and what is yet to be discovered in your world?
Well, what is known is the Dutch have colonies in, I guess, what we would call Southeast Asia. But China is very unknown and still subject to a lot of sort of exotic cliches and speculation and wild rumors. And it's sort of the holy grail of long-distance shipping. Nothing about Australia or the southern hemisphere, much below the Cape of Africa, is known at all. America's just been discovered. I think I have a couple of references to the New World, which is just being explored. There's some, obviously the North Pole, not known at all, speculation. That, yeah, that's about it.
Did you read Hampton Sides' book?
I did.
Kingdom of Ice?
I did. Went and saw him speak, and I read the book, and that almost led to some major revisions to this book, because as you know, there's a key element in the book called a paisa, which looks like a big medallion. And when he showed that slide, and then I read the book, it showed someone with a map of what they thought the North Pole looked like with the big ocean in the center. That gave me some really wild ideas for, you know, an alternate history exploration book. But I ended up tucking that away, but it may reappear in the trilogy somewhere.
So he's tried it before, but Bryn decides to stow away on a ship called the Tempest, and it couldn't go much worse, could it?
It could not. Bryn thinks the third time is a charm. He's tried to stow away twice before and been caught. He thinks he's got it this time. He has staked out in a local pub called the Gooey Duck. A sailor who works for a loosely guarded, maybe not top of the line, a queen's ship called the Tempest that's headed for the New World. Actually, I can't remember if I use the word Caribbean or not, or maybe I call them the Carib Islands.
The Caribs.
Yeah. But Brent has heard rumors that they have grass made out of sugar there, and he just can't imagine anything better. So this is going to be his ticket to freedom. But yes, things don't go well at all, and it involves the loading of gunpowder on the ship.
And after the resulting kerfuffle that happens because of it, he's held accountable in a court of law.
Mm-hmm. a kangaroo court of law. Yeah, my wild imagining of what a 16th century juvenile court might look like, presided over by a foppish, self-important judge who doesn't want to be there. He doesn't even get to official sentencing before Rand McNally, his father's boss, intervenes and has finally found the way to keep Bryn at home and doing what Rand McNally and Bryn's father have planned for him, which is to be a mapmaker.
Because he has a great skill. He has a great memory, and mm-hmm. he can just look at something once and repeat it.
Exactly. Speaking of anachronisms, I had to try very hard not to call that a photographic memory, which is what we would call it. I don't know what they would have called it in the 16th century, but yes, he can look at something and then duplicate it without a second look, which would be a terrific skill for a map maker, obviously.
But he has other designs on himself.
He wants to be the one discovering these worlds, not drawing them.
So were you fascinated with the Age of Discovery when you were young?
I was. Part of that, of course, is how it's depicted in books and movies, which is exactly what captivated Bryn when he's in those pubs. They don't tell you how horrible it is to live on a ship in the 16th century with no fresh food and water or, you know, a decent place to get to relieve yourself for months at a time. It just sounds exciting to discover a new world, to plant your flag somewhere, that everything across the ocean is more exotic than what you have. Bryn is lower middle class, as should be obvious when you read the book. And so the idea, and that's how they got people to sign onto those ships if they didn't forcibly take them, is telling them, you know, come with us. It's all gold and rubies out there, you know.
Since we were kids, the kind of view of colonialism has mm-hmm. changed a lot.
Very much.
And you even do make nods to that where you show that colonialism isn't a good thing.
Exactly. That was tricky because there's a lot of well-earned sensitivity in children's book publishing now about things like that, about sensitivity toward people of color and disadvantaged people and sort of history is told by the dominant majority over the years. So it's tricky because the book is from Bryn's perspective. So when it starts out, it has to seem like a great idea to him. You know, it all seems wonderful and perfectly natural that these European ships would be going to Southeast Asia to take things and bring back to their own people, you know. But yes, get through the whole book, you'll see that there's definitely a darker side to that that Bryn comes to understand.
And there are more darker sides to the book, too, because Bryn's punishment is just about as gross as it gets.
Yes, it is. Well, I got this idea. I sort of based Bryn on, I'd read about Jules Verne. When he was 12 years old, he tried to stow away on a ship. And he was caught, and his father punished him so severely that Jules supposedly said, from now on, I will travel only in my imagination. So his getting caught and being punished led to a great reward for all of us. He, you know, became one of the greatest fantasy and adventure novelists of all time. So I liked this. I was fixated on this idea of a boy's disobedience, his mischievous behavior, his insatiable curiosity, getting him punished, but then leading to an unexpected reward. So when he's caught, he's sentenced. Rand McNally has, as part of his map emporium, he has the Explorer's Lounge, kind of.
And Bryn has always wanted to go there.
He's always wanted to go there. This is where it's kind of like the National Geographic Explorers Club. And, you know, that was sort of an inspiration where all these great sailors and explorers, you know, come to partake of fine food and cigars and port and talk about all the worlds they've discovered. And Bryn thinks he's going to get to go in there, but McNally walks him past the gold doors to the vomitorium, which is where after you've indulged yourself all night on fine cigars and port and rich food, this is where the privileged people go to purge themselves so they don't have to do it at home. Vomitorium sounds like a very real, it is a real word, but it doesn't mean what you think it does. You know, it's a Latin word that just means like the opening of a tunnel, like football players pour out of at the beginning of a game. But because it sounds like vomit, there's long been this rumor that a vomitorium was a real thing that ancient Romans had after their famous feast to go and purge themselves. That turns out that's not true at all, but it should be true. And so I made it true.
Do you ever worry a bit that in calling it that, mm-hmm. and with the alternate history bits that you're maybe putting incorrect facts into mm-hmm. your readers' heads.
Sure, but it's fun. I mean, you know, I'm a fiction writer. I play on the borderlands of what was real, and there's a lot of factual stuff in the book, and then there's a lot of stuff that was just inspired by factual stuff and played with. Believe me, I almost wanted to put a warning in the book. You know, do not try to navigate a ship. Do not try to pass your history test. Do not try to stargaze based on the information in this book. But hopefully, if it interests you and excites you, you'll want to go learn more for yourself.
And so he actually has a boss in the vomitorium, mm-hmm. and that's Rupert. And he's kind of got the right attitude for it because he's not really enthralled with his job either.
Yeah, exactly. But he takes it very seriously. You know, this also comes from, of course, there's been a lot of popular TV shows and movies about the British service class. People who do a job that none of us would want to do, but at the same time take a certain professional pride and formality in it. And you know, Rupert is based on that. So he gives Bren very detailed instructions on the proper way to deal with a client in the vomitorium, whether it's bowing a certain way, presenting the bucket in a certain way.
And Rupert is also taking advantage that someone's doing the dirty work now. He can go elsewhere in the club.
Exactly. We don't see much of Rupert once Bren starts doing most of the dirty work.
It's pretty gross. And I know... You know, if this is aimed at kids, you know, kids do enjoy a certain amount of gross-out humor. But there's also a fair deal of violence with very real consequences in the course of the book. And yes. I was surprised because it's almost as violent, if not more so, than the adult books I read.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not good. But, you know, I depend a lot, of course, on my editor because that's all he does is edit books for children. And I did have several discussions with him about, is this going too far? Is this... From my perspective, if you research the history of the Age of Seafaring, this is so sanitized you couldn't believe it. At the same time, I didn't want to be – have you read The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle by Avi? It's a very popular book. It's a terrific book about a girl who ends up, you know, on a ship not quite in the 16th century, maybe in the 19th century, and having to take control and fight for her life. And it's a good book, but it's so – I mean, you just – if you're an adult, you read that and you're like, "That there's no way that could happen. That, you know, that is so unrealistic." So I didn't want adults to have that reaction, or even kids. I mean, because it is a very primitive world compared to what we're used to. It's a rough life being a sailor, and that's part of Bren being disabused of his romantic notions of going to sea and adventure. So I hate that you feel like it may have gone too far. I hope it didn't, but I'll try to be sensitive to that.
Well, I was just amazed on, you know, some of the acts that happened to people during the course of there.
There's a lot, you know.
I know it's accurate, but you know, I read a lot of crime fiction, and I was going, well, you know, this is right up there with it.
That's true. It's funny that you mentioned crime fiction because that was The Vanishing Island. I kind of wanted to be a melding of two of my favorite forms of book, from childhood, the adventure book, and from adulthood, the detective novel, because, you know, it's not just Bren getting on a ship and going looking for treasure, like in Treasure Island. There's actually quite a bit of clue chasing in the book and figuring out who's really the bad guy and who you can trust. And I definitely wanted some of that in there. So maybe that's where the violence came from.
And a mysterious death happens while he's at the vomitorium, which kind of kicks the main part of the story off.
That's right. That's sort of the inciting incident, as they would call it in screenwriting. His Jules Verne moment is when he's cleaning up the vomitorium and dealing with a client who doesn't look like he should be in there. He doesn't look like he's not dressed in finery. He looks like a very beaten down sailor. And obviously, if you pay attention to the clues, you realize it's Jakob Baenders from the prologue. And he gives Bren a very mysterious gift that Bren has to figure out what it is to make it his ticket out of MAP.
As if dealing with this isn't enough, he also has a rival his own age who is just a piece of work, and that's Duke Swires, the son of the wig maker.
You know, they're bullies all throughout history. Duke is the son of Cloudesley Swires. Cloudesley is just a terrific name. It was the name of an actual British sea captain when I was doing my research, and I thought, I just have to use that somewhere. It just sounds so pompous and ridiculously royal. This is the 16th century, so of course wigs and finery are very important. So he owns Swire's fine wigs and pomades. and Duke is his son, and Duke has nothing to worry about. He's going to inherit the empire of wigs, so he works his privilege out on the other children in town.
And so what kind of pomade do you use on your hair?
Me, I use an Aveda product. It smells good.
Looking for endorsements?
Yeah, that's right.
Because he doesn't want to follow his father's footsteps, he feels just a touch alienated from him, and his mother died when he was young. Mm-hmm. So his real mentor in life is an older man by the name of Archibald Black, who's kind of like an older, more erudite version of the cool uncle.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. His father's a good man, a kind man, but Brandis doesn't have anything in common with him. His mother was the storyteller, the adventurous spirit. She's been gone now 2 years, and that really left a wound in him that hasn't healed. But he does find some solace in Black's books, the bookstore owned by Archibald Black, who was a friend of his mother's. As I write in the book, it's kind of a blessing and a curse, because it's a place for him to go, someone, even though it's an older man, that he can relate to. But at the same time, there's this connection to his mother that, by hanging out with Archibald Black, keeps that wound open. And also, this is where he reads all these stories that come in and fuel his imagination to get out of MAP. But Mr. Black tries to be a good example to him and a good mentor and explain to him that running away is not the way to solve these problems, but he doesn't really get through to him ultimately.
Mr. Black deals in old books and antiquities, so he obviously wants to find out this thing he got from Banders what it is.
Yeah, so they get involved together in this solving the mystery of this, what they think is a coin, and then they discover is a paisa, which is an actual thing from the Empire of Kublai Khan, maybe all of the Mongol empires, but specifically the Yuan dynasty that Kublai Khan ruled over. His empire was so vast that when he would send out emissaries to the western regions, the southern regions, he would give them a coin inscribed with a message and the mark of the emperor to make sure that they were not molested by bandits. And it worked because no one wanted to mess with Kublai Khan, obviously.
And it seems like Coleridge mm-hmm. is a touchstone for you mm-hmm. because you have Kublai Khan, mm-hmm. and then you have a ship named the Albatross come up later from the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah, that poem definitely made an impact on me when I was younger. It's a lot of my classmates, you know, they make you read it in junior high, or I don't even remember when, but most people find it boring. But
well,
I
not if you listen to Iron Maiden.
Exactly. I found it very haunting, and I guess I didn't quite mean for it to be so Coleridge-centric, some of those things, but I guess it just slipped out.
Now, I was kind of disappointed that we got to meet Mr. Gray. Not much happened with Mr. Gray.
I have a cat who looks just like Mr. Gray, and so now my girlfriend and I call him Mr. Gray occasionally. I tried to think of a way for him to make the trip. In fact, I had a draft where Mr. Gray also gets on board the Albatross, but it just wasn't working. It was too distracting. There were too many things going on. So, yeah, he doesn't reappear. I'm sorry.
Now, eventually, Bren meets Admiral Bowman, mm-hmm. and he's pretty much the platonic ideal of a dashing sea captain.
Mm-hmm. He represents everything Bren imagines from books and these adventure stories. He's admiral of the greatest navy in the known world to Bren. He looks the part. He has the swagger of the part. But he also, when Bren gets to know him a little better, he represents something much more important to Bren. He's someone who came from humble birth in the Netherlands and rose to become this great admiral. And it validates for Bren this feeling that just because he was born to a lower middle class family, to a map maker, that he doesn't have to accept that fate.
Along with Admiral Bowman is a representative of the Dutch Bicycle and Tulip Company. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Richter is just, if you ever saw Aliens.
Yeah, he's the Paul Reiser character, yeah. Right? This was actually my editor's idea. I originally had an original draft where there was no Mr. Richter, and sort of everything you read about him was folded into Admiral Bowman. And my editor pointed out, he was like, I really think you should consider splitting these into two characters. Fortunately, I love my editor. I have a great editor. He's a genius at structure. All his notes are usually spot on. So I went back and I tried a draft where I played with this, and it was so much more freeing to take some of these characteristics or some of this behavior out of Admiral Bowman that maybe didn't fit with the other stuff, and then create this very lively, obnoxious, wealthy, plutocrat who's on board, supposedly to, you know, check on his investments, because that's really, this is one of the fascinating things to me when I research these shipping companies. It's really kind of like a modern day stock market. They have investors, they have a board of directors, or a commodities market maybe is a better way to put it. You know, all these people back in Europe buy shares in this company or put their hard-earned money to it. And then whether they get return on their investment depends on whether the ship makes it back safely from this year, 18-month-long trips to the Southeast Asia. And there's even a fascinating story about, do you know that the Dutch tulip bubble?
The investments and the crash.
Mm-hmm. You know, tulips at one point became, you know, this incredibly valuable commodity, and people were speculating on them and buying all these new varieties and species. The price for tulips just reached this explosive level and then just collapsed and, you know, devastated many people in the Netherlands and Europe overall.
Because essentially it was like buying on margin was for the stock market collapse in 1929. People would borrow money to buy these bulbs and they became inflated and inflated.
Exactly. And then suddenly they had just a worthless tulip bulb and they had mortgaged their farm.
And speaking of tulips, the series is The Chronicles of the Black Tulip. Mm-hmm. So what's significant about the Order of the Black Tulip?
Well, the Black Tulip represents something, kind of a catchphrase in the Netherlands or in Dutch folklore. Because the tulip is such a valuable flower, the black tulip actually cannot exist in real life. And nothing in the natural world can be black without being dead. That's the catch-22. Breeders have tried to breed a purely black tulip, but they just can't do it. They can get a really dark purple or whatever. So a black tulip became a symbolic of something that, a holy grail, something that everybody quests for, but, you know, no one can really achieve.
Now, also very important to the story is Marco Polo. Mm-hmm. And for our younger listeners out there, can you tell them a little bit about the significance of Marco Polo in world history?
Marco Polo was the Italian merchant who went to China with his father and uncle in the 13th century. I don't know if he was the very first European to go through China, do you know? But he was certainly the most famous first person to go visit China. He became an emissary of Kublai Khan, who ruled the largest empire in history. But he didn't speak Chinese. He didn't know anything about some of the western farther reaches of his empire because it was, you know, so vast and completely different cultures of people in it. He had Persians, Kazakhs, Uruguay people, in addition to Chinese and Mongolians. So Marco Polo, because he was so educated and bothered to learn Chinese, he became useful to Kublai Khan as a sort of an emissary to travel the empire and then bring back information about what was going on out there. So he was granted this amazing access to what had been a very closed-off culture and wrote a book that some people think was greatly fabulized about what he saw there and what he did. I mean, some people think he never even went there. Like, for instance, he never mentions the Great Wall of China in his book. But from what I've read, there are just too many details in his book of travels that have been verified. There was even a group that for National Geographic, these two adventurers who recreated the exact route he took. I think he definitely went there. Stuff like now mentioning the Great Wall of China. By this time, a lot of the original Great Wall had fallen into disrepair with stone and mud. Kublai Khan ruled so much of the empire, they weren't really concerned about fortifications to the north because the Mongols had already taken over, you know. But he was there for 20 years. He finally returned to Europe just in time for the civil war between Venice and Genoa, and he was imprisoned, and he actually dictated his famous book of travels in his prison cell to a man who happened to be a fiction writer. So that leads to a lot of speculation that some of the story was embellished. You know, he claimed to see a unicorn. He probably saw a Sumatran rhino, you know, that sort of thing. But
that just points out that, you know, he was gone 20 years and people back home really had no idea if he was still alive at any point.
Right.
Because there's no reliable post system and there's definitely no telecommunication.
Yeah, obviously. But when he did come back, and with these amazing stories of what he had seen, it fueled this unprecedented interest in all things Chinese, Oriental, just everything, the spices, the clothes, the wealth of Kublai Khan. I mean, it really fueled interest in other Europeans going that way. And it didn't quite launch the Age of European Exploration. That would come a little bit later because, you know, Marco Polo took a land route from Italy through the Middle East along the Silk Road to China. That ended up being closed off when the Muslims took over the Middle East and conquered Constantinople, Byzantium. And that's what really sort of launched the seafaring, you know, looking for seafaring routes to the southeast and all those exotic treasures of the Far East. But by then, China, when the Ming Dynasty took over China, they completely shut the culture off, destroyed a lot of evidence that even they had explored other countries, stuff that wasn't discovered until much later, that, like the Chinese had actually had these brilliant discoveries in astronomy and seafaring and navigation and possibly gone, you know, to Africa, maybe even the New World. You know, that they didn't even want that known because that would fuel interest in people trying to get to China.
Because European technology and the seafaring was not as advanced at that time.
Not at all. They didn't even know how to calculate longitude, which is where you are east and west on the globe. I mean, seafaring started out basically staying in sight of coastlines, because otherwise, once you were out at sea, you could tell where you were north and south by the angle of the sun. That was easy. But east and west, the sailors were completely lost. It's amazing. When you look at how little they knew and how poor their instruments were, some of the stuff they did is just amazing.
And longitude wouldn't be solved until they got accurate timekeping devices.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Yeah, so I can't explain it coherently to your listeners right this second, but yes, longitude depends on calculating your distance in time from a fixed starting point. And they're, you know, when they were on a ship before the invention of a high-tech chronometer, I guess. I read the book about that. That was fascinating, too. Longitude by Davis Hobel. It's a great book. Yeah, there was no reliable way to measure time like that. And so they came up with sorts of lunatic ways. My favorite was the wounded dog theory. Do you know this one? Supposedly, there was something called sympathy powder. And so they would deliberately wound a dog, like, cut its leg back in Britain, London, say, and apply sympathy powder to the wound and then give some of the sympathy powder to the sailor. And supposedly they would like deliberately make the dog bark or cry out or something at noon every day. And supposedly on the ship that this would be shown to them in the sympathy powder and that so they would know what time it was back in Britain.
We're going to leave the rest of the book to the readers because there's so much more that Bryn goes through and experiences when he does finally hit the open sea. But are you already working on the second installment?
The second installment is with my editor even as we speak. The lead times in publishing these books is incredible. They're already working on cover art for book two. He has the first draft. My editor typically sends like 30 pages of single-spaced notes that makes you feel like you've done nothing right. But they're good notes, and they'll make the book stronger. And right now, I'm just trying to enjoy a couple of weeks before the launch of the first book of not having to write every night and weekend around my day job.
And what is your day job?
I work at Archer Malmo. I'm brand content manager for one of their clients' websites.
And so that's fancy advertising speak?
It's fancy advertising speak.
Now, with the art on the cover of the first book, you have the same artist for the next one as well?
Yes.
It has a fabulous kind of Eastern-inspired flavor to it.
Yeah, her name is Priscilla Wong. She works for DreamWorks Animation, actually. And, yeah, she did a beautiful job of bringing the East and West together, which, of course, is important to the whole series. Yeah, she will be doing the cover for book two. They hired a different illustrator who did some of the fantastic interior art, like a map that looks very period, a cutaway of the ship. And I don't know if you noticed this, but both the map and the cutaway are designed to look like they're from the archives of the Dutch Bicycle and Tulip Company. So this same artist actually created a real logo for the fake shipping company that adorns the map and the cutaway, which I think is super cool. It's even on the half title page right there. Property of Dutch Bicycle and Tulip Company.
You ought to get some book plates printed up with that so you can send them out to people that want autographed copies.
Yeah, I think that's so cool.
So when is book two scheduled to come?
They try to do trilogies or books in a series. It's about a year apart, so I assume that it'll be sometime September next year.
Well, Barry, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing The Vanishing Island with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Barry Wolverton is the author of The Vanishing Island, the first book in Chronicles of the Black Tulip, which is published by Walden Pond Press. And if you'd like to meet Memphis author Barry Wolverton, he'll be signing his new book at the Booksellers at Laurelwood on Thursday, September 3rd at 6:30 p.m. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.